This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the rise of white hate groups in the United States. A 2018 film, recently released, takes an intimate look at one man's escape from a life of neo-Nazi hatred. In the past, we've covered the harsh laws related to sex offenders in the United States. Today we delve deeper. A book by two professors examines the lack of justice in sentencing autistic and developmentally disabled offenders. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In the recently released 2018 movie, Skin, skinhead Brian Widener's body is covered in racist tattoos, each marking a hate crime he committed. His parents, Shireen and Fred Hammer Krager, run a kind of camp that recruits and trains young men, often lost, often hungry, to become white supremacists. Brian meets and falls in love with single mother Julie Price. When he begins to realize he wants to give up his hateful habits, he faces a host of difficulties, one of which is the long and painful process of removing many of the hate tattoos that cover his body. The film follows writer-director Guy Nativ's Oscar-winning short film of the same title. In the narrative version, actor Mike Coulter plays the film's true hero, Daryl Lamont Jenkins, who has devoted his life to helping people escape neo-Nazi groups. We're delighted to have Daryl, founder of One People's Project, joining us in the studio today. Since 1988, Daryl has been documenting and writing about right-wing individuals and organizations, even back while serving as police officer in the U.S. Air Force. In 2000, he founded One People's Project out of a counter-protest to a rally in Morristown, New Jersey. The organization quickly gained the reputation of publicly documenting hate groups and their activities. Daryl Lamont Jenkins, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hello. Good to see you. Good to see you again.
Daryl, do you recall what first got you interested in fighting right-wing groups and individuals?
Oh, boy. You know, it goes so far back to the point when I was a kid, because, you know, I was raised by good parents. and basically, they were educators. And to that end, my father was really big on history, and that kind of transferred over to me, so I was into the civil rights movement since I was born in 1968, just a couple of months after Martin Luther King died. And, you know, I grew up in the suburbs and I didn't see it all anymore. It didn't look like there was much racism when you're 10 years old. Everybody seemed to be okay and all that. So I always wondered, where did all the white supremacists go? So you start seeing articles in your weekly reader when you were a kid about the Ku Klux Klan and about Bill Wilkinson, who was a Klan leader at the time. And you realize that there's still a problem. And then you realize that, you know, folks like Tom Mesker, you start hearing about as you get older. It really wasn't until I was in the Air Force and I'm doing my thing there and I'm watching TV, Oprah Winfrey's show comes on, and it's about what was called at the time skinheads. They're not really skinheads, that's another story, but but that show made me realize that maybe it's time to start documenting these folks. So that's where it all began. I started videotaping, or rather dubbing, any of the TV shows that featured the Klan, Aryan Nations, or other forms of neo-Nazis, and I still have those tapes to this day, actually. And then it went into dealing with the rest of the right, because you start listening to conservative radio, you start listening to Pat Buchanan. This is where I start hearing about Pat Buchanan for the first time. And you hear them saying the same things that you hear that the Nazis say, but they're Republicans. They have standing. And it's like, okay, so now I got to follow this. And talk radio was just like a gold mine for me, especially the late not-so-great Bob Grant. Because he used to let these same neo-Nazis leave their contact information over the air. So it was just like, okay, we're on to something here. So it went from there to one day back in like 2000, there was a white supremacist rally that was being held in Morristown, New Jersey. We organized around that. That's what started my Group One People's Project.
Daryl, you touched on terminology. Let's just clarify a few terms. We have neo-Nazis, skinheads, white supremacists. Are they all the same?
In many respects, they are. They're just different facets of the same jewel, to be honest with you. I say that when you're looking at neo-Nazis, there's a certain political motivation with that. With fascism, there's a certain political motivation with that. Just straight up right-wing neoconservative things, there's another motivation. But it's all a part of the same jewel. And I don't even know if you can call it necessarily a jewel, but just for the lack of a term. But I think that there is a barometer that you have to go by, because they play with these terms. They mess with you and try to suggest that you don't know what you're talking about if you call them a Nazi or a white supremacist. So say, how can you call me a white supremacist when I'm black? Okay, fine, you're a fascist. Okay, I mean, that's how it works.
Who are the Proud Boys?
Perfect example of that. That's who. Proud Boys got started in, I would say, around 2016. It was put together by a character by the name of Gavin McInnes. He used to run, he founded Vice magazine, and he left there in 2008, and then he's decided, in the advent of Trump, to create this thing called the Proud Boys, which is supposed to be a group that will go out there and fight people and
physically fight
people. People who he politically disagrees with, you know, the argument that they have against Antifa. So, and he makes no bones about that's what they're there for. They say, he says on one of these radio shows that violence is a really effective way to solve problems. And in fact, to get, to become a full-fledged Proud Boy, you have to engage in physical violence against somebody politically. And I'm going to tell you something, and they call that their fourth degree. There's a few Proud Boys sitting in jail right now because they went to get their fourth degree. Some here in New York, some are on their way in Portland. So they are a nasty group, and they try to pass themselves off as just a drinking group, and they're just having fun. They always do that. They always, every conservative or every neo-fascist that I deal with, they always try to play the game that they're just joking around, they're just having fun. You know, the Klan, actually, that was their beginnings. The origins of the Klan was that they were supposed to be this fun, frivolous group to help Confederate soldiers get shake a lot of what they had to deal with off from the Civil War. But we saw how that manifested itself. So
before we talk about the movie Skin, I have one other question in terms of where individuals can find these hate groups online. Are there websites? Well, I know there are, because once I accidentally got onto one searching for something. But are there a lot of websites run by these groups? And are they mostly on the so-called dark web?
They're not necessarily on the dark web. They're up close and personal. And that's one of the more frustrating things about social media when it comes to this kind of thing. Because, you know, when you look at what Facebook and Twitter has allowed on their platforms, it's not like that they can't get rid of it. They just don't. They do it every now and again, which is why the Proud Boys and company decided to hold a rally. That is why the Proud Boys and a number of groups decided to hold a rally on July 6th to protest against their denial of freedom of speech. They're getting kicked off a platform, so they held a rally to cry about that. But they have their own platforms. They have Gab. They have Minds.com, which is holding a conference in Philadelphia on this weekend. They have their own platforms, so their freedom of speech is not being violated. But those are two places. I mean, there's some places like 8chan or the Daily Stormer. Those are the websites. But I think the biggest, as I pointed out before, I think the biggest problem that we have is the social media platform, social networking.
Now, Daryl, you have helped neo-Nazis leave behind their affiliation over the years. And one of those persons was Brian Widener. Can you tell us how you met? He's the subject, along with you, of the film we're going to discuss. And how did you begin to tackle such a daunting process with Brian and others?
Well, one of the things, when it comes to helping them out, when it comes to helping them get out of these things, I can't chase after them to tell them that there's a better way or whatever. They have to come to me. It's kind of like my father was also a drug counselor, and I make this point in the movie. Or rather, Mike Coulter makes this point in the movie. But in any case, it's a case of you have to be ready to get out. If you're not ready to get out, my obligation is going to be to those that you are going to hurt. Those people of color, those women who are trying to advance themselves and so on. My obligation is to them. So when you come to me, that means you're ready. That means you are seeing that there is something bigger and better.
And they know they can come to you.
And they do know. They do know. Or in many cases, not so much. Because Brian's wife was the one that came to me first. And he didn't know she came to me yet. She hit me up online to talk. I introduced her to a discussion board that we had, the One People's Project had on the website, so she was able to talk to people there and get a lot of support. Then Brian talked to me, and we didn't talk politics. We talked music. That was it, because that's my vocation. That's my thing, music. So we was able to talk about the various things we saw in the punk scene. We saw just in general. We was able to break the ice that way.
You related on a human level.
Yeah, because bottom line is they need to feel that human level.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, when you're talking to somebody, and even when we're going through our day-to-day, when we're going out there advocating for whatever it is we're advocating, we got to approach it from a human level. It's not about some political strategy. It's about you being you.
Well, and it's also, I would imagine, about affiliation. And for a lot of individuals who hook up with these groups, they want to be a part of something.
And that is an important thing to remember. Because when people were asking me as we were doing the movie whether or not if I would like to set up something to help people transition out of the white power scene. And I said, look, if and when I do that, I'm not just going to be focusing on people who are trying to get out of the white power scene. I'm also talking about those gangbangers trying to get out. I'm also talking about those people who have been radicalized. I'm talking about those people who are in cults. They're all not only looking for that same thing. They went to these things because they felt that their lives were not worth a damn. They found some people that made it so and made things worse for them. Now they want to get out. They can really help each other if we set up the right program.
Well, if anyone can do it, Daryl, I'm sure you can with your with your system. Now let's talk about the movie. I've got to say, I watched it last night. I rented it online. In 2 minutes, I was like, this is intense. And, you know, I've got to say, I wonder how you can have this your life when it is so grueling just to watch a two-hour film. It was riveting. I loved it. How did the film Skin come about?
Well, after we started talking, Brian Widener is the person we was just referring to. And he had knew he was getting out. He was done. Once he was able to leave the area, he was a member of a group called the Vinlander Social Club. And he was like one of their nastiest enforcers at the time.
And his parents were involved, or his adoptive parents were.
I'm not too sure about that. I mean, I'm not very sure about that.
So the movie might have taken a few liberties.
Oh yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yes, sir. I understand. Yeah, there are some liberties in the movie,
right?
Of course. But once he got out, the one thing that isn't a liberty is the fact that he wanted to get those tattoos removed off his face. A lot of the Vinlanders, if you ever see old pictures of the Vinlanders, you see they have all kinds of facial tattoos, body tattoos, and all that. He said he was done with that. He needed to get them off his face. It was not helping him as he was trying to transition. So we helped him out with that.
Because he'd apply for a job and they'd look at him and say, are you crazy?
Yes.
No one is going to hire you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
He once tried to put acid on his face. This was actually, so he actually was getting these tattoos removed thanks
to us and the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yes. They did a documentary on it. It was a documentary produced by a gentleman named Bill Brummel called Erasing Hate.
Oh.
And that documentary was on MSNBC back in 2010. It was on Netflix for a little while, and that's when a lot of people saw it, and a lot of people thought that this is powerful to watch. And one of the people that thought it was powerful to watch was a guy in Israel named Guy Nativ, who was actually, he read, there was an article about it, and about Brian's story in a newspaper. He was reading it, and he said, you know what? I got to get in contact with this dude, because this has to be a movie. So he talked to Brian. He did all the things that he needed to do. And we had the movie, but it was had the script, but it was tough to get a studio to sign on to it, producers to sign on to it. Then along comes Oren Moverman, who was a big producer, Trudy Styler from Maven Productions. They came up and said, yes, we have to do this movie. Everybody was thinking that there are no neo-Nazis in America anymore. I mean, we live in that weird world where everybody thought that everything was hunky-dory. And then we see otherwise when you're looking at Trump. And when you're looking at the things that have been going on over the past two some odd years. So Trudy Styler and Oren Moverman came along, said, we are going to do this
and
movie.
Wasn't the timing perfect?
Exactly. The timing was perfect.
You couldn't have planned it better.
No. And the sad thing about it is this problem is evergreen. It's never going to go away until we make it go away. And as long as we keep on pretending that it went away, we have issues.
So bringing it out in the media, in social media, and in films like this is critically important. Now, I want to ask you, there's a current of fear that permeates this entire film. Mm-hmm. And I understand, because I watched an interview, and it was shown in the film with Brian, that after he made the decision to leave, people came and attacked his house, his family. They lived in constant fear.
Yes.
Is that something that you see with individuals who try to leave the movement?
Always, always. They're always going to be worried that not only do they have to concern themselves with their crowd coming after them for betraying them, they have to live with that. They know they have to live with it. They know that there's a lot that they are going to have to atone for. I think that in the case of Brian, he also has to deal with, you know, himself trying to make sure he's able to cope without that thing that they used to have. Now, he's been out of it for a good long while now, so he's definitely coping now. But I think one of the important things for him, if you ever meet Brian, and I really hope you do, you would meet a person that really likes to talk not to people, but with people, because he is still learning. He really does appreciate having conversations,
engaging with others.
Yes, he loves to engage. He loves to just be a part of everyone else.
Well, there was a scene I loved in the film, and it's not giving too much away because there is a love story in this movie, and that love was instrumental in changing him. But when his girlfriend-to-be meets him early on, at one point he looks at her and he says, what are you looking at? And she says, you, and with, you know, attraction and love. And then you see him looking in the mirror at his tattoos over and over, and you kind of see his face and character evolving as he turns into from hate to love.
Exactly. I mean, I think there's a lot I wish I could talk about in the movie. I mean, I don't want to give anything away too much either. But when you see his relationship with his daughters in the movie, the dog. My mother watched this movie, and she had, I mean, my mother's a Christian woman. She's an elder in a church, so she wasn't big on the profanity and
the drinking,
and what she called the pornography. But she really did started feeling for Brian when he saw the relationship between him and the girls in the movie. She wished she could have been up here to meet him. Incidentally, we were showing this at the Village East, and I'm not really sure if it's down there still. But
listeners should check.
Yeah, we should check. Hopefully it's still there.
Yeah.
But we had a showing. We brought out Brian.
Oh,
me
great.
And Brian came on. They brought us out to meet the audience. he got a standing ovation, and he fell apart. He loved it. He loved it. He needed that.
And I cried at the end of the film. Yeah. I mean, it's a real story of redemption and hope. Yes.
I would not say that it's redemption because he's still got a long way to go. Oh, I mean, he's not a bad guy. Don't get me wrong. But
it's a process.
Yeah. Even Jamie Bell, who plays Brian, would say that this is not a redemptive story.
Interesting.
So it's like, and he would agree with it. Brian would agree. No, I'm getting there. I mean, there are things that I still need to do. There's still things that I have to atone for. And he is atoning for.
Is he still in fear for his life?
He's always going to be in fear for his life. He's always going to be that. I mean, you never know, especially since the Vinlanders are now running around with the Proud Boys and calling themselves the American Guard.
They're still in existence.
Oh, no. The Vinlanders. The actual Vinlander leader, Brian James, started another group since the Vinlanders fell apart.
Oh.
And they called themselves the American Guard. If we saw the footage from Portland a couple of weeks ago, there was a scene in which there was a guy, there was Antifa was dealing with some people in a bus who was swinging a hammer at them. It ended up on Fox News because they was trying to make it look like it was Antifa attacking this bus.
Of course.
Poor innocent protesters. Well, those poor innocent protesters were the American Guard. That was who was in the bus.
Wow.
So it's still going on. It's still an issue.
Now, let's talk about how our current president has fueled some of this hate. What has it done since Donald Trump has been elected to bring this into the forefront in the public's conscience?
Well, I would say that it wasn't by Donald Trump's design. And this is important to note because everything that we have been dealing with over the past couple of years is bigger than Trump. In fact, this crowd that used to call itself the alt-right, now they realize how poisonous it is, this crowd were the ones that were really pushing for Trump. And we didn't think that he was going to win. They didn't think that he was going to win. So basically, it was just a branding effort on their part. Now that he has won, they realize, oh, we can do something now. I mean, when you think about the fact that Stephen Miller is a friend or a one-time friend of Richard Spencer.
Oh, and let's talk about Richard Spencer. Who is he, briefly?
Richard Spencer is the executive director or maybe president of the National Policy Institute, a white supremacist group which was based out of Virginia. He is basically the go-to guy when it comes to, if you want to talk about white supremacy now, because he was a really active in the white power scene. Mm. I mean, basically, he was the one that came up with the phrase alt-right, alternative right. He had it for his blog. That's how impactful he is. He hasn't been all that active in recent years. After Charlottesville, he started dwindling down. We see a few events that he would hold later, but in recent months, he hasn't really been all that active. But when he was active, his whole thing was to try to incorporate his ideals into the Beltway of D.C. He worked out of D.C. He was raising money for Ron Paul, and you see him on C-SPAN introducing Ron Paul on for some event. We started following him then because we was already looking at a group that he was associated with. This was back in 2006-2007. And now he has basically brought in a whole bunch of young people that have no business being involved in this nonsense.
What do you mean by that?
Well, see, when I first...
Recruiting?
Yeah, recruiting most part. Yeah, when he started holding his conferences, that's how a lot of people know Richard Spencer. He started putting together conferences for NPI, the National Policy Institute. The first one that I went to, it was basically a bunch of old white men. Really, there was probably about one or two people that were women in that room, and one of them was with me. I was the only black man in the room. I mean, and this was at the National Press Club. Cut to 2016, right after Trump got elected, 300 people at the Ronald Reagan Building in D.C., young folks, most of them. And that was when we realized, okay, we got something to deal with.
Yes.
And, of course, everybody knows Richard Spencer really well from 2 months later during the inauguration. He gets punched in the face. So now we have a debate. Is it okay to punch a Nazi? Yes. But but that's another story.
Well, that leads me to sort of the final part in terms of action where we are now. Recently, Senators Ted Cruz and Bill Cassidy condemned the anti-fascism movement, calling for its designation as a domestic terrorist organization. What do you make of this?
It's a game. It's a game. It's not going to happen because here's the deal. Anti-fascism, Antifa is not a group. It's an ideology. It's an ideal. It is a principle. And if you believe, if you're against fascism, if you're against hatred and bigotry, you are Antifa. So if they pass such a law, that means you could be sitting at your home going through your day-to-day and get picked up because you're a part of a terrorist group, according to Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and all this crowd. So it's not going to happen. We're not going to let it happen. But it does speak to the fact that we need to start letting people and more or less reinforcing the idea that those are the bad guys. It's funny how Ted Cruz and Donald Trump decided to do this in the wake, lead up to Portland 2 weeks ago, when you had somebody with the Proud Boys, with Patriot Prayer, the other group that was in Portland, basically saying he was going to Portland to fight Antifa. That's all. His name was Joe Biggs. He's out of Florida. He was flying into Portland to fight Antifa. He just kept on saying it over and over again, showing the weapons he was going to use, making videos about it. And we end up becoming the bad guys, according to Donald Trump and Ted Cruz.
Daryl, I have to ask a final question before we let people know how they can learn more about you and One People's Project.
Sure.
Your work is really, I can't even imagine how challenging it is. How do you keep your spirits up?
Well, you know, you stay human. And most important, that's the most important thing. The second thing that you have to remember is that we're winning. We are beating this. It's just we're at a bad point, but we'll come around. We'll deal with it.
Maybe the tipping point.
Yeah. We're better people than we give ourselves credit for, to be honest. And that's one of the reasons why they keep having the problems that they do, because every time they pop up, we're going to show up. And when I say we, I'm talking about community.
Yes.
Is going to show up and say, no, not here, not now, not ever. That's why their new location for this conference is being kept secret, because they know that we're going to respond to it.
Daryl, the film is amazing. You are, through Mike Coulter, the actor,
yes.
really the hero of the film, even though you're not in it as much as the main character, Brian Widener. We hope that people will see this. You can get it online. I think it's going to be in some theaters. People should check.
Yeah, it should be in some theaters. There's some Oscar buzz, so it might be in theaters again.
I hope so.
They're looking at Jamie Bell for...
And Jamie Bell, all of the people were phenomenal.
Jamie Bell did great. Danielle McDonald did great. Vera Farmiga. They were out of sight. I'm going to give love to Russell Posner, who played Gavin. Because I loved what he did with the role. And then just all of them, everybody.
It was phenomenal.
This is my first movie set. So.
Well, let's hope you're on many more. How can people find out about the One People's Project?
One People's Project is, you can find us at onepeoplesproject.com. We also have a news line called idavox.com, named after Ida B. Wells, idavox.com.
Okay.
You can find me on Twitter at D. Lamont Jenkins and on Instagram at D. Lamont Jenkins. And I also want to point out about the month of October, where we're working with a crew out of Tennessee called the Dangerous Ideas Collective. We want to have an entire month, dedicated to unity and to support anti-fascist efforts and culture and just us being us. On the 5th of October, we really are trying to get a national march. People simultaneously holding marches across the country, maybe even across the world, promoting unity and anti-fascism. Because we need that now. If Donald Trump and his crowd is going to start attacking us in the name of what we are supposed to be, then we got to fight back. And this is the way we speak out. This is where we get to say, I am Antifa. Make something of it.
Daryl Lamont Jenkins, congratulations on the years of work you've put into this.
Thank you.
The movie Skin.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The U.S. legal system and sentencing practices rely too often on emotion rather than facts when it comes to defendants with developmental disabilities charged with sex offenses. Sentences for possessing child pornography are severe and do not take into account a defendant's lack of awareness or inability to understand the societal values being punished. This is true for individuals on the autism spectrum whose social intelligence quotient may lag their intelligence quotient. Two professors want to change that. St. Francis College professor Emily Horowitz and co-editor and law professor Larry Dubin make the case for reform of these laws in their book, Caught in the Web of the Criminal Justice System, Autism, Developmental Disabilities, and Sex Offenses. Today we welcome Professor Horowitz to talk about the book and her work related to sex offender laws in the United States. Dr. Horowitz is chair of the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at St. Francis. She's the author of Protecting Our Kids, How Sex Offender Laws Are Failing Us, and founder and co-director of the St. Francis Post-Prison Program. Her research on the Sex Offense Registry is widely cited. Professor Emily Horowitz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
In your book, Caught in the Web of the Criminal Justice System, you quote author John Elder Robison as saying, quote, "When I was 12, I had the language skills of a college professor with the social intelligence of a five-year-old." Now, I've read that 1 in 40 males is estimated to be on the autism spectrum. Why did you write this book?
Well, let me give you a little context. So I wrote a book before this called Protecting Our Kids, How Sex Offender Laws Are Failing Us. And that book is a critique of the sex offense registry and the sex offense legal regime, which is all the laws that apply to people who are convicted of sex offenses, which are really excessive and not productive and not effective. After I wrote the book, I started meeting a lot of people, mostly parents, who told me about their, mostly sons, who were diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum, who had gotten caught up in sex offense crimes. They'd been arrested and convicted of crimes involving sex offenses. Many of them were arrested for non-contact offenses, looking at illegal images on computers. And after I met these people, I started reading a lot about it, and it turned out it's very difficult to determine the prevalence, but there is a group of men who are on the autism spectrum who are being convicted of sex offenses involving these illicit images, and they're very immature, and it's a problem. And so this book is addressing this problem.
Now, prior to 1980, you write in the book, there was no federal legislation prohibiting the possession of child pornography. And as you just said, most of the laws have not, in fact, been effective in terms of deterring violence against children, child pornography. Can you tell us why these laws were enacted in response to what exactly?
Yes, so I can tell you very specifically, they were enacted in response to a few very high-profile stranger abductions of children, and you probably know their names, Eitan Peitz, Megan Kanka, Jacob Wetterling. And these crimes are horrifying and terrifying. Unfortunately, they're extraordinarily rare. Most sex offenses involving children are not stranger offenses. Most people who commit sex offenses involving children are first-time offenders. So these laws were enacted due to kind of a hysteria about the worst kinds of crimes that could possibly happen, but those crimes are statistically completely almost insignificant. Crime's been dropping for decades for all offenses. Sex offenses involving both adults and children have been dropping for decades, and these laws were enacted to respond to a kind of panic.
A moral panic, as it were.
Yeah, a moral panic, a sex panic.
Right.
That sort of started with the daycare cases where people started to believe that children in daycare were being sexually abused by groups of adults, often with satanic overtones.
It almost seems as though some of these laws, an easy way for law enforcement to make arrests, make convictions, but not really getting at the root of the real problem.
Absolutely. I mean, these laws are absolutely about vengeance, not justice. Once you're arrested for a sex offense, there's many, many laws in place. You don't need extra laws. You don't need sex offense registry laws. The problem is most sex offenses don't come to the attention of criminal justice. Most sex offenses are committed among non-strangers. So these laws don't really get at the pervasiveness of sexual wrongdoing that's happening in society. And I would argue the criminal justice system is never going to be the place where we really get at and address the most common and most pervasive sex offenses. And it's very interesting because public concern about criminal justice issues is increasing, right? We hear a lot about mass incarceration. We hear on the left and the right presidential candidates coming up with plans to decrease the prison population. And the concern about mass incarceration runs across the political spectrum. But at the same time, sex offenses are kind of orphaned. They're not mentioned. We've made some progress, but for some reason, sex offenses are not included in this these reform efforts.
That's right. We rarely hear about them, in fact. How does the United States compare with other countries in terms of dealing with crimes related to child pornography, for example?
I don't know specifically about child pornography, but I do know about sex offenses in general. Almost no other countries have public registries the way we do. There's been a couple of cases of countries where they refuse to extradite people to the United States because they would face sex offense charge when they come back, and those countries have said that our laws are a violation of international standards and these laws are inhumane. Most countries do not punish sex offenses with the extent of draconian and vengeful responses that we have. I mean, we have enough ordinary punishments to deal with people who are convicted of sex offenses. We don't need special laws, registries, residency restrictions, presence restrictions, civil commitment, electronic monitoring, even castration in some cases. These are all excessive, and they don't improve public safety. They don't reduce recidivism. They're very, very costly. And what's most troubling is that we know that the best way for people to do better after they have a conviction for any crime is to help them with reentry, to help them reintegrate. These laws drive people into poverty and homelessness and hopelessness, and they actually do things that increase recidivism.
Yes, that was mentioned in your book.
Yeah. I would also say one impetus for these laws is the myth that people who commit sex offenses are different than those who commit other types of offenses, that they won't stop, that they can't stop, that they're predatory, that the recidivism rates are frightening and high. But the data shows exactly the opposite. Recidivism rates for people who commit all types of sex offenses are very, very low. We know that for whatever reason, punishment works, arrest works, prison works for sex offenses, and we don't need extra laws for them. So they're based on a mythical, hysterical, inaccurate idea about people who commit sex offenses.
As you were talking about reentry, it made me think of so-called problem-solving courts. We've seen a lot with drug courts where counselors assist individuals in getting treatment, job placement. It seems like this might be an appropriate, possible way to address this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. It should be addressed through problem-solving efforts, through social work. We know treatment is effective. Like any type of offense, treating it with harshness and vengeance does not work. It's not effective. And it doesn't reduce recidivism, and it destroys lives. We know the best way to increase public safety is to help people who've committed any kind of offense, right? We see that with drug offenses. We see that even with gun courts and other types of really exciting initiatives that are coming out of DA's offices all over the country. But we don't see it yet with sex offenses.
In the book, Caught in the Web, the case of Nick Dubin really gives heart to it. Tell us about mm-hmm. Nick and what happened to him.
So Nick was a young man who was on the autism spectrum. He had never had a relationship, a physical relationship, like many people on the autism spectrum. He'd never been educated about sexuality, as many people on the autism spectrum are not. It's sort of a very taboo subject. And he was very comfortable using computers. A lot of people who are on the spectrum use computers in various ways. And he used computers and looked at illicit images. He'd never been in trouble with the law before. He was a psychologist. He actually gave talks throughout the country on autism and Asperger's and being on the autism spectrum. And he was caught with looking at these images on his computer. Luckily, his father, who I co-wrote the book with his father, was a law professor, and when Nick was arrested in a pre-dawn, really vicious raid, his father started becoming educated and did everything he could to help his son avoid prison. He was a first-time offender. He was assessed, but I think it was really clear that the courts treat these crimes so harshly, and there's so many mandatory penalties, and there's so much humiliation in these laws and in the way we treat it, that his father was really shocked that there was no justice in his son's case and became an advocate. And both Nick and Larry Dubin help other families who are dealing with this. And I think they get calls all the time from families dealing with the same situation.
One thing I found stunning was the fact that three psychologists, two who I believe were experienced in dealing with autism cases, evaluated Nick, and even the one appointed by the prosecution recommended leniency in his sentencing. But why did the prosecutors not listen to their recommendations?
Well, I think, and you see this with not just people on the autism spectrum, with all of these cases. For my book, Protecting Our Kids, I interviewed dozens and dozens of people on the registry, and many had similar stories. They were either having a manic episode, many were veterans dealing with all kinds of issues, and their lawyers, you know, made excellent cases for leniency and provided context, but because the cases involved sex, the prosecutors refused to look at any of the extenuating circumstances as you would do in any other case. And I think that's what's most interesting about looking at people on the autism spectrum, is that here's a condition that would clearly be something you would consider when you're sentencing, and because it's a case involving sex, you do not.
I remember in the book, when describing how Nick got into this predicament, I believe his father wrote that, you know, he didn't have that many friends. I think some of them shared the images with him. And as you said, he had not had experience in real life or physical domain. So the photographs were kind of experimentation, or you could say part of his education. Is that, do you think that's a common reason that some individuals on the spectrum might be just curious online? And it, I would imagine it feels like a safer environment to explore sex.
Yeah, I think because they don't have physical contact, or they're not comfortable physically with other people or emotionally connecting with other people, they use the computer to find all sorts of fulfillment.
You teach sociology. Do you teach this subject to your students?
Yes, I teach a course on sex crimes, and it's really amazing because we spend the whole semester, I just taught it last spring, and we spend the whole semester reading all the studies about low recidivism rates. We hear stories of people like Nick and others who kind of get trapped in these laws for various reasons. We read about methods that have been proven in other countries to reduce rates of sex offenses. And the students are very moved when they, we even meet a few people who are on the registry, and they're very moved by the stories of people who are kind of destroyed by these laws, particularly young people who get caught up in Romeo and Juliet scenarios, like 18-year-olds with 14-year-olds. But at the same time, by the end of the course, they're like, well, we understand these laws are absolutely terrible and make no sense, and were not developed out of criminological or sociological research. They were politically prompted by panic and misunderstanding and myths about recidivism. But they still are like, well, I wouldn't want to get rid of them just in case. As you see just in the media, we hear all the time about, you know, how somebody who murders somebody should have a lighter sentence than somebody who touches a child. You're treated better in prison if you kill a child than if you touch a child, right? There's such hysteria and panic and misinformation surrounding this issue. But I do find after a semester they are much more rational and much more aware of how these laws are not based in any kind of evidence at all.
And in the book, I believe you talk about, or one of the contributors addresses laws related to child abuse, such as physical abuse, neglect, maltreatment. We don't hear as much about the punishment for that kind of mistreatment. Certainly, I would think that a lot of those laws, as you suggested earlier, could be used for some of the sex offense cases.
Right. Well, you definitely see movements towards having like a child abuse registry, animal abuse registries, how, you know, there are efforts to extend these to other areas. But it's true. I mean, people who are very much in favor of these laws, and they say these laws are so important. There, all the rhetoric about the laws are protecting our kids. These laws protect our children. Yet at the same time, you don't see that much interest in laws and policies that truly protect our children. For example, with child physical abuse, we know that poverty, parental drug abuse, and other factors really lead to child physical abuse, right? But you often see people who are very, very supportive of the harshest penalties for people who physically or sexually abuse children, right? You see all this hysteria about hot car deaths now, right? These parents should fry. These parents are terrible. These are the worst people in the world. But you don't see a lot of support for policies that we know could help families that are in trouble.
That's a good point. Now, we have a few minutes remaining. Every day in the last few months, we've been reading about Jeffrey Epstein's offenses in the newspapers. Do you think his case and the earlier failure, I guess, of the courts to mete out punishment years ago, do you think that's going to hurt efforts to raise awareness about over-punishment for certain sex offenses and any kind of reform, given the so-called panic that's arisen around his case?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not good for the 900,000 people that are on registries when the media is completely fixated on the case of somebody who supposedly got too light a sentence. Now, in the case of Jeffrey Epstein, that his initial punishment could have been the result of very skillful lawyering, and he had lots of resources to hire lawyers, but maybe also there was a lack of evidence there. But the problem is the way it's presented makes it appear that the laws are not tough enough, when the laws are more than tough, particularly in Florida, where he was prosecuted, right? In Florida, there's such strict residency restrictions for people living in Florida that there's an internationally known case of a group of people with sex offenses who were living under a bridge because they literally could not find any housing where they could live that was within the right amount of feet away from daycare centers and other places. So I think his case is just something that's captured the media's attention, but it is very dangerous because there is this kind of sense that, oh, if we had, you know, harsher sex offense laws, he would have not been able to be out. He would have been put away for life. But our laws are pretty harsh. So I would imagine in that case it was a result of, as I said, very skillful lawyering and his resources, not the fact that we don't have enough laws.
You referred to the individuals living under a bridge. Let's just remind listeners how the sex offender registration laws, and we're talking about a federal registry.
There's a federal registry and there's registries in all 50 states.
Is one more restrictive than the other, for example, in terms of so-called presence restrictions, like where they can and cannot live?
Yes. So residency restrictions depend on states, counties, towns, for example, like the city of Miami, because they have extreme laws in that city preventing people from living in certain places. Residency restrictions, though, depend on city, state, and community regulations, but the registries are throughout the country. There's some states, like, for example, in New York, if you're a level one, you're not on the public registry. However, it's a registry that's accessible to law enforcement or daycare providers and things like that. So if you want to work with children, those who hire people who work with children would have access to people who are level one. In other states, everybody's on the public registry.
Okay, we have just one or two minutes. Is there anything we haven't covered?
I would just say that sex offense registries are terrible. They're a form of perpetual punishment. They give nobody any incentive to change. They turn registrants into suspects. They're ripe for profiling. And people on registries face discrimination, harassment, and vigilante attacks. As we've talked about today, the developmentally and intellectually disabled are hit particularly hard. Gay men are overrepresented in the prison population. And we also know that black men are registered at higher rates than white men. We don't need a registry. The existing criminal statutes provide more than enough punishment. And we really need to rethink naming and shaming.
I've also heard that in some situations, individuals convicted of sex-related offenses are actually kept in prison sometimes longer than their sentence. Have you heard about that?
Yes, absolutely. In New York, because in order to be released, you have to find housing, and there's many shelters and many places where you cannot live if you're on the registry, if you have a sex offense conviction. So you will stay in prison until you can find a place to live. So it's a really big problem in New York, even in New York City, and throughout the country. But I live in New York, and I'm familiar with many people who stay in prison beyond their release date simply because they can't find appropriate housing. Mm. We see with Me Too, there's a lot of emphasis on victims, but I think accountability is key. We want to end sexual wrongdoing. But we also want to avoid vengeance. Vengeance is not good for victims. It doesn't help anyone. We want people who make mistakes to get better. And elevating sexual mistakes to a point where people should be punished forever doesn't help anybody.
Well put. On a final note, how did you become interested in this subject?
I met somebody who was on the registry, and I was completely shocked at the hurdles and barriers to his reentry. And I learned about it, and I was completely overwhelmed. I mean, I'm a sociologist. I thought that, you know, if you went to prison and you served your time, when you got out of prison, you know, you could reintegrate and become like everybody else. And I was shocked. It was in New York City, and he was unable to find housing. He was one of the things that had helped him a lot in prison. He became very religious, but he was kicked out of his congregations. Many congregations don't allow people on the registry to worship there, and he was asked to leave his congregation. He struggled and struggled to find housing. Getting a job was basically impossible. Even places in New York City, there's a lot of resources for people who are dealing with reentry, and there's lots of opportunities for trainings and different things, but most of them exclude people with sex offense convictions.
So it's really a sentence for life.
For life. And his picture was everywhere. Mm. And anybody who ever Googled him would see his picture, his age. And even though his offense had taken place when he was 19 and he was now 33, it was even impossible. People would see that, you know, he was 33 and the victim was 14 or something. But it would look like he was 33 and the victim was 14. Nobody was doing the math to see that he'd committed the offense when he was 19.
Professor Emily Horowitz, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about a subject that receives, I think, far too little attention. So we want to thank you for that. Both books, Protecting Our Kids, How Sex Offender Laws Are Failing Us, and the more recent, Caught in the Web of the Criminal Justice System, Autism, Developmental Disabilities, and Sex Offenses. Both are enlightening and in a way dispiriting to read, but hopeful that we as a society will have the moral courage to reform some of these laws. How can listeners read more of your writings?
Well, I would say there's a couple of advocacy organizations that post a lot of current information about these laws. There's the Alliance for the Constitutional Reform of Sex Offense Laws, ACSOL, and that's a really good resource to read news and updates about legal challenges to sex offense laws.
Emily, thank you for being on Law and Disorder. Best of luck with your future work.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.